You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined in the park at Red Lion Square, just outside THE's headquarters, by Chancellor Nicholas Dirks at the University of California, Berkeley, and Scott Biddy, Vice Chancellor for Universities Relations at the same institutions. Thanks for thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Chancellor Dirks, you've been in the role since June 2013, so almost a year exactly. How have those first 12 months been? Surely you're at a leading institution, it's renowned, it's got an enviable academic reputation, an endowment worth, several billion dollars in one of the most vibrant parts of West Coast America. Surely it's a walk in the park to lead such an institution.
Yeah, it's a walk in a park just like this. It's actually been a terrific year, I have to say. The University of California, Berkeley, as you say, it's renowned in so many different areas. It's got as many highly ranked, and I mean really highly ranked, often within the top five, certainly the top 10 departments, schools, programs, and colleges as really any other university in the United States, with the possible exception of Harvard, that has a few more. But when it's ranked, whether by department or by university, and for that matter, by you, it's always, inevitably, the highest ranked public university in the United States. And it's usually surrounded by Harvard, Stanford, MIT, sometimes my old institution, Columbia. It's, to me, a wonderful opportunity to have a university that is excellent across everything it does in the academic arena, at the same time that it is a public university with a very powerful sense of a public mission, an extraordinary record of accomplishment when it comes to maintaining access and affordability, and recruiting extremely diverse students from spectrums of the socioeconomic from the socioeconomic spectra that really is does distinguish it in stark terms from all the other peer private universities with whom it's usually ranked. But the walk in the park, it's an extremely complicated institution, of course. I came from a private institution, so I'm learning not just about the glories of being in the public sector, but also about the challenges. It's part of the great system of the University of California with nine other campuses. It reports to an office of a president in Oakland, California, and it's governed by a board of regents who are appointed by the governors of the state of California. And of course, it also inherited major cuts, along with the other campuses of the University of California, in state funding for higher education.
It's had a bit of a battle, in fact, hasn't it, the California system in recent years. Is that something that still causes problems on a daily basis for you?
Well, it does. The 40 years ago, tuition at the University of California, this is true at every campus, tuition is set across the system, was almost nothing. The current governor of California, who's been the current governor of California for many years, Jerry Brown, went to Berkeley 40 some odd years ago and says that when he went there, tuition was $75. So what's happened is that over the last 25 years, the state allocation represents an increasingly smaller part of the overall percentage of the budget of each campus of the University of California. But what happened after 2008 is that what had been a steady decline became a precipitous decline. We went from a budget in which 33% of our funding came from a state allocation in 2004, which was when my predecessor, Bob Birgeneau, was inaugurated, to a situation in 2013 when I was inaugurated where only 12% of our budget came from the state. And the issue now, even though the precipitous decline has stabilized, we actually have a 5% increase marked in the budget of the state of California for next year. It's a 5% increase on a very low base, and there doesn't seem to be any likelihood that that base is going to go up in any significant way. So a 5% increase on a 12% proportion of our overall budget means it's a 0.6% increase in a budget of $2.4 billion.
Is that enough to even stand still?
It doesn't even allow us to fulfill contractual obligations with various categories of unionized labor on campus, leave alone increase faculty salaries, deal with the kind of competitive issues that we're dealing with, increased levels of financial aid, and of course continue to fund both the extraordinary education that we offer and the amazing research that we perform on campus.
I guess finding money would fall to some extent under your responsibility, Scott. How do you go about plugging those gaps?
Well, so we've just completed a very large campaign. We raised $3.13 billion, which is, we feel, was an extraordinary success. It's the largest campaign of any institution in the U.S. without a large medical enterprise, because most of our peer institutions have large hospitals and medical schools. So it was very successful. It increased the size of the endowment meaningfully, but as it relates to fundraising, we came to the game relatively late. So many of our lead private peers, Stanford, Columbia, MIT, Harvard, Princeton, have been at this game a long time. So we're still playing catch up, although we've closed the gap considerably.
Why were you slow out the block?
Well, in large part, it was because the state was so generously supporting it that there was just no mandate to go out and get private support. We've been raising money privately really since the inception of the institution. But in the post-World War II years, there was, it's a little-known fact, but there was essentially a gentleman's agreement with Stanford that because Stanford relied so heavily on private support, that Berkeley wouldn't aggressively go after donations. And now those tables have turned.
Yes.
Although Stanford is still raising money hand over fist, as you might imagine.
Yeah, we'd like to have a new gentleman's agreement.
But having said all that, I think the other difference that we have is that the institutions that have raised money very successfully have a different approach to undergraduate education than most of our public institutions. And so I think one of the things that we're really focused on for the long haul is to really, in some fundamental ways, change the quality of the undergraduate experience that will build that deeper sense of loyalty. Mm. Berkeley is different than other public institutions in that our alums really love the place. Even when we're bureaucratic and a little difficult to deal with, they still have a deep and rich connection. Converting that into philanthropy is something we have to invest more in.
Sure. I should reassure everyone that the sirens around are nothing to do with us. We are in a fairly busy part of London at the moment. Chancellor Dirks, you referred briefly there to your previous roles. You were at Columbia, so switched from east to west coast, as it were. Any similarities? What would you say the big similarities and differences are between a university like Columbia and your current employer, Berkeley?
Well, in some ways, Columbia prepared me rather well for the role at Berkeley. It's a place that has, for example, a history of student activism, and I think between Columbia and Berkeley, they set the sort of gold standard for student participation in different kinds of issues confronting the university, which is a constant source of interest for those of us who are in the university administration.
What are the notable incidents?
Well, notable incidents go back, for example, in the case of Berkeley, I mean, really the beginning of student activism on American campuses was in 1964, 50 years ago, with the free speech movement. So we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that this fall at Berkeley. But Columbia was, of course, very, very active in 1968 and has had, along with Berkeley, a tradition of students participating, having hunger strikes around issues like ethnic studies and feeling very passionately about maintaining the focus of both universities on responsibility to their communities, to their neighborhoods, to students, dealing with issues around cost and debt and so on and so forth. But at Berkeley, that tradition converged with the crisis around funding. So, excuse me, for the last few years, we haven't had any major activity on campus, but when state funding was being so dramatically cut after 2008, and when we had to therefore increase rather significantly the amount of tuition that we charged. Still much, much lower than in a private university, but nevertheless much higher than it had been. The tuition rose by what percentage, Scott? I wasn't there at the time, but...
It rose, over the course of 3 years, it rose by over 40%.
So the tuition now for a year for an in-state student is just under $13,000. Tuition at Columbia is around $50,000, so it's still less than that. But it represented a major shift in terms of how the university was being funded. And students were very active in registering their protests. They said this is a public good, and therefore it should be paid for by the public. We still believe that education is a public good, but we understand that the financial model has to shift. At the same time that while we raise tuition, we work very hard to increase the amount of financial aid that we make available, not only to low-income families, but also to students who come from middle-income families, in ways that are actually quite similar to places like Columbia and the more financially well-endowed private institutions that have sought to be both full need and need blind in their admissions. But you asked about some of the similarities and some of the other differences between Columbia and Berkeley. They're both great institutions. Columbia is part of the Ivy League, but it's always in some ways been the kind of public Ivy in the middle of that league, because it's taken many, many more students from public schools, which in America we mean, of course, we mean government schools. And it's been much more engaged with its local community. In some respects, Columbia shares other kinds of features with Berkeley. It has always been seen as one of the, in some sense, the public Ivy in the Ivy League, and that because it took a much higher proportion of students from public schools, from government schools, than many of its peers in the Ivy League, and also because it was much more of its community, namely New York City, and not only New York City, but Harlem. And so it had to engage its immediate environment as well as the sort of larger community, of course, that is part of constructing what the Ivy League is all about. But Berkeley is, in many ways, it ranks even better in many of its programs and departments than Columbia does. And yet, of course, it is a public institution. Now, I was talking about that before, but some aspects of that are to me, still really inspiring and help me get up every morning and fight the good fight for this great public institution. For example, we have 36% of our undergraduates on Pell Grants, which means they come from families making less than $45,000. That's an astonishing statistic, and it's virtually as many students in number as are distributed across all eight of the Ivy League institutions who are on Pell Grants. So it's a remarkable statistic and a remarkable contrast with the Ivy League. At the same time, as I was saying before, we're working to create better financial aid and support the Pell Grant. It doesn't cover the full cost of attendance. And at Berkeley, we're able to give financial aid so that 40% of our undergraduates pay no tuition at all. We've also increased financial aid levels so that students coming from families making up to $150,000 have limits in terms of what proportion of their family income they have to pay for college. So Berkeley has the same set of commitments to providing as much financial aid as possible as the Ivy League. At the same time, that it has a much more diverse student body, and that diversity is hardwired in the institution, and it's part of its being public, well beyond whatever amount we get in terms of funding from the state.
To move the conversation on, I was looking at your biography actually from your time at Columbia. It told me you're an expert on British colonialism. You're an anthropologist. Indeed, that's your specialism. There was a quote related to you, and it's about your keenness to make the anthropology department at Columbia more international. You said you wanted to hire more professors from parts of the world that have typically been the objects rather than the subjects of anthropological learning or anthropological inquiry. Is that an ideal that you've taken into university leadership? And you know, what are the challenges of recruiting high quality overseas faculty and integrating them into a, you know, an institution like Berkeley?
So the professoriate in top American universities is already highly international. But the truth is that it has been more international in some of the science and applied science and engineering fields than it has been in social science and humanities. So what I was referring to in my earlier life as chair of an anthropology department at Columbia was the need to make sure that across all fields we look at global talent globally and try to bring in not only some of the best faculty, but bring in faculty in particular fields where international perspectives and backgrounds can actually help complement and even transform the kinds of ways in which humanist and social scientific inquiry takes place within the university. So I was committed to recruiting a more international faculty in anthropology at Columbia, and in fact, when I became dean of the faculty there, I continue to do that across many different fields, well beyond the sciences and engineering. And this indeed is a commitment that I bring with me to Berkeley. And one of the three pillars that I've established as part of my new administrative initiative is around emphasizing the importance of building on the global history, the global relationships at Berkeley, but trying to establish a better set of relationships and a better kind of footprint of a global kind for the university as a whole. So that includes recruiting faculty from different parts of the world, but it is not exhausted by that. I've been interested in developing new kinds of collaborations where our faculty can work and partner with faculty from different parts of the world on research projects, but also in developing new kinds of educational programs, providing opportunities for our students to engage in international and collaborative research, to spend time in internships, and to prepare themselves, as indeed we must make sure they do, for being citizens of a very different kind of global world than perhaps was part of the original mandate of the University of California when it was established way back when in 1868.
This is a question for both of you, I guess. I mean, regrettably, one of your fellow University of California institutions was in the headlines last month after six students were killed, three of whom as a result of a shooting. The victims were all UC Santa Barbara students, although it should note that the incident was not on the campus. How did this incident, which obviously was very widely covered, how did it affect the University of California community, and I guess you as senior members of it?
Well, I'll begin, and then Scott, perhaps you can say something. But of course, it was a terrible tragedy, and our hearts went out both to the families and students who were affected, but also to the university leadership at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Henry Yang is chancellor there for many years. He was actually in Boston when the shooting took place, and it's been incredibly hard for him and his colleagues. We immediately got in touch with their student counseling and student affairs group and sent down some psychologists and counselors to help them deal with just the kind of horrible aftermath of that tragedy. Of course, we also think about it as a university community in terms of what would happen if it happens on our campus. How would we respond to it? So all the chancellors of the universities in the California system got together actually just a week later in Oakland. And among other things, we talked about how prepared we are for something like that to happen, what we would do in order to try to prevent it from happening. We have, in fact, protocols at Berkeley, and I've confirmed this with our chief of University of California Police Department at Berkeley, Margot Bennett. We have protocols for what are called welfare checks, so that if there is a complaint or a concern registered about a particular student, we not only will send the University of California police personnel to visit the student, but they will go and talk to the student's roommates, friends, associates, classmates, faculty, and of course we encourage faculty to identify students who might be in trouble or who look like they are depressed or disturbed in some way. And we also run gun checks so that we do follow through to see if there is the possibility of a problem of mental health or a problem of somebody's life circumstances generating this kind of outcome.
How does a gun check work?
Well, there are public records as to who has bought guns legally. Gun checks, of course, don't work if weapons have been procured illegally. But the point here, of course, is that in the United States, it's impossible, clearly, to prevent these kinds of things from happening. We're doing what we can as a campus community to do that. But we also have to prepare ourselves in the event that something like this does happen. Scott, you've been at the University of California, Berkeley, much longer than I have.
Well, no, but I think that there were a number of unique features of this one, and that is the perpetrator was actually not a UC Santa Barbara student. He was a student at Santa Barbara City College. So when you're working at a place like UC Berkeley, you know, it's difficult to know where the threat may come from. And so it's a particular challenge. And I think in many ways, UC has put in good policies and good procedures to deal with this. We had an incident on the Berkeley campus several years ago, which could have gone very badly. And in fact, the police handled it extraordinarily well, and no one was hurt. But you just never know where the threat will come from.
There are groups, of course, that say citizens with appropriate licenses should be allowed to carry concealed weapons on university campuses, as they can in almost, you know, any other part of the country. I mean, what do you say to those groups in response to that particular belief?
Well, fortunately, California has stricter gun control than many other states in the United States. And so we don't have that particular issue in California, thank God. And I don't think it's going to emerge, but the kind of incidents of violence associated with guns across schools and colleges in the United States over the last few years, it's hard to know where to say it began, with Columbine or with Virginia Tech, with Sandy Hook, or now with Santa Barbara, we hope, a kind of wake-up call that we have to do more than we've been able to do in order to control for the possibility that something like this will happen in our own school, our own college, our own university.
Mm-hmm. Finally, there's a presidential election on the horizon, 2016. People speculating about who's going to run, who's not at the moment. To what extent do you think higher education will feature in the discussions around that vote? And also, I guess, what do you think Obama's higher education legacy will look like when those votes are cast? When we look back at his time,
it's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
What's his legacy?
Well, I'll take your question from the last part and then move backwards. President Obama convened a group of university leaders in the White House last January. He brought us together in large part to discuss issues of access, affordability, of recruitment of students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. There's been a number of studies done recently, including by Carolyn Hoxby, an economist at Stanford, to show that students from certain kinds of backgrounds, typically students who don't have anyone in their families who have gone to college, students from underrepresented minorities, students from low socioeconomic backgrounds, tend not to look beyond 25 miles for a place to go to college, tend not, even when they are performing very well in school and are encouraged by their counselors to apply to the top universities, tend not to do so. And even when they get in to Harvard or Berkeley, often tend not to go. So this is a problem that has been addressed in the literature as undermatching, and that was one of the things that the White House was concerned to discuss with us. And so what that meeting led to, in fact, were commitments on the part of many university leaders to do more in the way of things they've already been doing, but to do more. And some of these programs had been curtailed after the budget cuts of 2008-2009. In relationship, for example, to going into the high schools and even middle schools to try both to encourage students with high academic aptitude to apply to prepare for an application to one of the top colleges, including our own, but also to get the kind of training they might need to supplement what they're getting in their local schools. At Berkeley, we have summer programs, we have outreach programs, we have students who do a great deal of service in schools as tutors, as mentors, and we've been working ourselves to do as much as we can to encourage students across every spectrum to think about a University of California education. So that, I think, is something that is going to be a continuing emphasis on the part of the Obama administration between now and 2016. In fact, yesterday, I missed this because I was in the air, but there was a call that the White House initiated for all the people who were part of that January meeting.
Everyone, of course, was at that meeting.
Well, no.
There were probably more higher education institution presidents not present than were. I mean, it was a small...
Perforce. And in fact, you know, there were more than 100. I think when they organized it in the first place, they were concerned that there wouldn't be that big a response. And so they were starting with a certain swath of colleges and universities in order to see what kind of interest there would be out there. And of course, there was pushback from leaders, for example, of community colleges and some of the larger state institutions that they weren't included. I don't think that was part of the intention, although I do think that one of the provocations of this whole meeting was to address the problem in some of the top schools of undermatching, which is a specific problem to that particular group of institutions. But, you know, the issues here are things that we can address up to a point, but it is, in fact, extremely difficult to sometimes really address the kinds of challenges that we're confronting, because these issues are fairly deep. They're deep culturally, deep in socioeconomic terms, and will take many, many years to address. But as far as the larger question about higher education as part of the political debate, I don't think it's going to be a defining issue for the 2016 presidential campaign. But I do find it remarkable that over the course of just the last 2-3 years, higher education has become a national issue in a way I don't think it had been for many, many years. Not perhaps since 1960 and the announcement of the master plan in California and the promise at that point that you could have a high-quality educational opportunity available to broad cross-sections of the American public well beyond top elite private institutions, and now of course that promise, that sense that these kinds of opportunities were going to be a fundamental part of the American dream, these seem all to have been deeply compromised by the rise in the cost of tuition and the problem of student indebtedness, and of course also in the relationship between how difficult it is to get into these colleges and then how difficult it is once you get into them and even do well to get a job when you leave them. So these are going to be issues that are going to be out there, and I think they will continue to circulate, not just for academic leaders, but for the public in a broad sense, even if it's not the defining issue for the presidential campaign.
Nicholas Dirks, Scott Biddy, thank you for joining me, and thanks for talking to me today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.